On this week's episode, we'll talk music and movies with Empire Records and FM. No static at all.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another edition of the Video Culture Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ryan Acree.
I'm Matthew Essery.
The other co-host. So, this week, we are jamming, we're jamming on two movies that feature music very heavily in them and more surrounded of music, not music documentaries per se, but movies that really captured the era of the music of the time. Yeah.
Basically, movies that feature really heavily on what's called needle drops. And needle drops are where they take popular songs and insert them into films. So these aren't the movies aren't filled with like original compositions. It's not really orchestral scores, but they take like top 40 hits and drop them into the film.
Yeah, man, totally. I mean, there were top 40. Some of them weren't as top 40 as you know possible, but some of them were music from the time period. But we can get into that. The first movie that we will talk about, and let me turn this down for a second, because I've got to turn your microphone up a little bit, is we'll just get into it and talk about Empire Records.
Yeah, 1995's Empire Records.
What do you have to say about this film?
Well, let's give a little bit of backstory on this.
Right.
I'm 40 this year, so I was around 15 when this movie came out.
Okay.
So, this movie was very popular amongst my age group.
Yeah, I mean, I was 17. I graduated high school in 1994. So, I mean, this is definitely of, you know, kids my age that would have been, you know, working at the store at the time. I mean, very similar in age group to not only the actors, but also the people in the store. And I think this is one of those movies where the actors are actually close to the age of what they were playing.
Yes, I mean,
right?
there's not like 30-year-old guys playing these parts. I
no,
mean, it feels like they have younger people doing these characters.
Yeah, definitely.
But you know, I'd always heard good things about this movie. I was always told that you should watch it. Uh-huh. And as a kid, I was like, I don't really think I would like it because it seemed very kind of, you know, because again, it was the 90s. I was 15. It seemed
right.
And I don't mean to be dismissive, because I remember I was 15.
Right.
It seemed girly.
Right.
And it just didn't seem like my thing. I'd much rather watch Clerks and Mallrats again for the 800th time.
Yeah.
Because these movies came out around the same time, and they were really compared a lot with Empire Records.
Right.
People were like, oh, you like Clerks, you'd like Empire Records. And I'm like, would I really? And I just
we'll get into the differences, but essentially the idea behind Empire Records, it's not about a record label, even though it's called Empire Records, it's about a record store, which, you know, we don't really have that much anymore in 2019. You know, Tower Records has been closed for several years. There's hardly any more local music stores. Most people buy their music online, but the only time you can find physical media is if you go to Target or Walmart or to a used record store.
Or if you buy
used music or media store or whatever they use.
Or if you buy it from a specialty shop online.
Yeah, or you can buy it from Amazon or, you know, somewhere like that and have a CD sent to you or album sent to you. So this was, I mean, it really sort of models like a Tower Records.
Yeah, it definitely looks like it's meant to invoke the idea of being a Tower Records, even though it's supposed to be a locally owned shop.
Right.
It's, you know, it's brightly colored. It's, you know, got listening stations. And really, it makes the whole film kind of a relic of an era that doesn't exist anymore. I mean,
right.
You know, it's, I mean, it seemed, I don't know how this movie plays to people younger than us, because there's kids out there now who we may run across this movie who've never seen a record store.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a DJ booth where the music is played from, and they play a little game with, like, M&Ms to, you know, who gets to be the DJ or be the DJ that starts the day or, like, whatever.
Yeah, it's as relevant today to kids today as if we were watching a movie about a silent radio play when we were kids.
Right. Now, one thing about this movie, it's very sort of big budget.
It looks expensive for what it is.
Yeah,
it's got a pretty talented cast of young actors. I mean,
yeah, Anthony LaPaglia plays like the manager of the establishment. He's kind of the older adult who's like, you know, does all the hiring and firing and really the person in charge of the store, because all the rest of the kids are just like the clerks and everybody else. Yeah.
And they're basically just like, you know, teenagers and early 20-year-olds. And it's got a young Renee Zellweger in it.
Yes. Liv Tyler, who was in all the Aerosmith. Yeah. You know, videos.
I think this was her first real non-music video acting job, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
I think she's even in the credits, basically says Liv Tyler from the Aerosmith videos.
Yeah. I think she gets like the and introducing credit kind of thing. And it's got some other actors who you've seen other things. There's that one actor's name I'm blanking on who was in Can't Hardly Wait. What's that guy's name?
Ethan Embry.
Ethan Embry, yes, yeah. Ethan Embry, who was in the good team movie called Can't Hardly Wait.
Now I'm not getting good at actors' names. I just happen to have it in front of me.
That's okay? that's why I cue to you to say it.
I keep the cast names in front of me, but it's the other actors that I don't know. No, but also it stars Robin Tunney, who was in The Craft.
Yes,
you know, very. Very beautiful lady. Mm-hmm. And then a couple other guys that were, you know, Maxwell Caulfield, who was in Grease. You know, he kind of plays like the artist who's there to sign, you know, autographs for the day, plays Rex Manning.
Yeah, it's Rex Manning Day.
It's Rex Manning Day.
Let's digress for a minute. This is my first real problem with the movie was I couldn't buy it
anymore. How many do we have? Do we have time? Are we going to be able to talk about FM?
I'll try to keep it brief.
Okay.
But one of the plot lines of this movie, and there's not a lot of plot to it, but one of the plots is that they've got this former child actor turned musician coming to the store to do autographs.
Yeah.
And his name is Rex Manning.
Right.
So throughout the movie, they're like, it's Rex Manning Day. Let's get all the you know, decorations in place, that kind of thing. And they show clips of his music video. Give you an idea of who he's supposed to be. And I cannot buy that anyone would really be a fan of this guy's music or him, because the music video they show is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was almost like they were trying. I mean, they were definitely trying to make fun of this guy.
Yeah.
That he was a has-been, like, maybe from the 60s or 70s. Like and then all of a sudden he's trying to make this, you know, kid music or pop music or, like, whatever. I mean, not even, like, a big name. You know, just somebody from, it's like, you know, Bobby Darin, you know, making stuff for, like, you know, in the 90s or something like that. Like, it's just kind of weird.
Yeah. But they had fans there who were, like, really excited to meet him. So it was really incongruous to me.
Yeah.
Incongruent. That's the word I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
But
I mean, all of his fans are, like, you know, women. And there's even a scene where it's like, the you know, it's like a adult, you know, a woman.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, I love, you know, all your old records. He's like, well, what about the new one? She's like, yeah, I love that one, too. You know? Yeah. And it's like, that's what his fan base is. His fan base is, you know, because he's from another, like, from a bygone era, who happens just to have a hit, and he's trying to, like, get seen, trying to get, you know. But let's talk about the plot for a second.
There's not much of one.
Well, it starts off with one. I mean, the whole premise of the movie is that you have this guy Lucas, right?
Yeah.
Or Lucas, he like knows that the it's an independent store, and the owner, who is not the manager, not Joe Reeves, right?
Yeah.
Not the actual LaPaglia. Right. The actual business guy.
Yes.
Is about to, you know, sell the store as an independent franchise, right? Like they're going to become like the Tower Records or like a Camelot. I think it was Music Town, I think was the name of
like how they remember the logos look like Sam Goody music, that kind of thing.
Yeah, something like that. So they were like, no, we can't, you know, they were, you know, but they knew that he was kind of in a financial sort of strap.
Yeah.
So this was, you know, Lucas's first night closing the store. Decides he's going to get the wild idea to go to Atlantic City, which they don't say. They don't really say where, you know, this place is, but you're assuming that it's somewhere in New Jersey.
Yeah, it's close to water. They do show like water or near the store.
Well, it was filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina, but you get the idea is he went to Atlantic City.
Yeah.
But there's no way he could have gone to Atlantic City from Wilmington and then drove back, right? So it's not really based in Wilmington. It was just filmed there. But you get the idea. It's like maybe on the Jersey Shore or something like that.
And the movie kind of opens with him giving this typical 90s narration where he's obviously using verbiage and wording that no normal person would use to talk about something.
There's very pretentious. Yeah, I mean, the whole movie is very sort of pretentious.
Like, well, there was this thing in the 90s where characters would give monologues to the camera in kind of a Ferris Bueller type way, but they wouldn't talk like real people. They would talk like really smart, like quip machines.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what this was. So they show him taking the money and going to the casinos, and he, at first, is pretty successful. Like, he wins money.
Yeah, I mean, he has $9,000, rolls seven, doubles his money. Yeah. He could have, I mean, basically, he could have taken the $9,000, said, okay, here's the deposit. Now I have $9,000 to play with. But he decides, no, I'm going to go double or nothing. And then what does he get? He rolls snake eyes, gets nothing. So you know from this part of the movie, like because he goes to Atlantic City, when you see him enter into the casino, the first thing I thought to myself, this is going to end bad. Yeah. We're already at the beginning of the movie. This is going to be bad.
Yeah, and it's pretty predictable. I mean,
yeah, it's very predictable.
I mean, it's very telegraphed.
Right, but then he doesn't get in trouble. He doesn't get fired, and then it really doesn't even become an issue almost until the end of the movie.
Yeah,
it's like all this other stuff happens, and you almost forget about that this thing.
Yeah.
Bad thing happens.
Like he goes back, and basically the boss just yells at him a lot. You know?
Yeah. Like, what did you do? He's like, well, your money's in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
I mean, he kind of grapples with the idea of reporting it stolen or turning him in, but he doesn't.
Yeah. You know? There's just no consequences to anything. I mean, no one acts like a human being in this film.
And none of the other employees are like, yeah, what did you do, man?
Because then you find out that the money that he took was going to be used as part of a down payment so the guy could actually buy the store.
Yeah,
and so they could keep it open.
So Joe could buy the store.
So Joe could buy the store, so they could keep it open as an independent record store.
Right.
So Lucas ends up inadvertently causing the problem that he was trying to fix.
Right.
It's all very contrived.
It is very contrived.
Yeah.
I mean, I just didn't like how we have this sort of MacGuffin, right? And there's nothing really even keeping it along. Hardly.
Yeah,
they almost have to force keep it along. As stuff happens, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they don't really address it again until almost the very end of the movie.
Yeah, like it's addressed a couple of times, but just to kind of keep it fresh in your mind, like the store owner comes by and says, hey, where's the deposit? Where's my money?
Yeah.
And then Joe hands him a bag and it's like, you think it's over, you know, but then it's really not, you know, it's just like...
But most of the movie is really just about these kids coming into work and their little side stories. They aren't really about anything. Like one of the characters is depressed. One of the characters is in love with one of the other characters. You know, it's all just
One is just like very jaded. One's, you know, very sort of goody two shoes and like, I am gonna go to college. Yeah. I'm gonna go to Harvard.
Yeah,
you know.
But she's addicted to speed in a very kind of 90s after school special kind of way.
Yeah.
And one of them is a little bit of a teen sex pod. One of them is kind of the sensitive artist type who draws pictures of the college girl who he likes. And
then the goofy guy who you mentioned earlier, Ethan Embry, he's just like a you know, pot smoking, like, you know, shroom eating kind of goofball.
He's just there for comic relief because if it wasn't for him, there wouldn't be a lot of jokes in the movie.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
And even the jokes he's in don't make a lot of sense.
Right.
There's a little scene where he's doing drugs at one point, and he imagines he's in a Gwar video.
Yeah.
And literally for no reason whatsoever, he's just for like 2 or 3 minutes, he's just hanging out with Gwar.
No, he's in the video. Like, you imagine, he's like watching the video, and then like he starts imagining him being in the video.
Yeah.
He's getting swallowed by the big like
snake, you know, worm thing. Yeah. But yeah, but no other payoff to it. Just like this little aside, like, hey, now he's in a Gwar video, you know?
Yeah.
It's really random, and like, there's subplots that aren't, to me, that just weren't that interesting.
I mean, and really, I just thought that he was a more sort of drugged out character from the same character that he played in Can't Hardly Wait. You know, it's just like, oh, the same dumb character now has found pot and shrooms and, you know, is tripping out on it, you know, all the time.
Yeah. And basically, they hope you'll care about the one character who's, there's this guy who wants to be an artist who's in love with Liv Tyler's character.
Right.
But he's afraid to tell her.
Right.
And
yeah, the artsy guy.
Yeah. And Liv Tyler's character is in love with Rex Manning.
Right.
So they got like this kind of pseudo love triangle thing in a way.
Right.
And I don't know what you mean, but I didn't care what happened to any of them.
No.
Not at all.
Well, I mean, this had like every 90s cliche like in it.
Yes.
Like, as I was watching this movie, I was sitting there thinking, like you and I both said when we first started talking, this is you know, we both grew up in this era and of the time period.
Yeah.
And then when I watched it, I'm like, this is what adults or like Hollywood thinks who we are or, you know. And I don't know if I was any of these characters, but I knew a lot of the, you know, similar characters. Yeah. But they would never do all of these things, like not the way that they did in the movie. It was just like very super far-fetched.
Yeah.
Like the way that Liv Tyler, just like, I wouldn't say Liv Tyler, but her character, Corey Mason, just like takes off her clothes in front of Rex Manning.
Well, I was a fan of that as a viewer, but that's neither here nor there.
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. But I mean, I never.
Yeah, it would never. Even as a kid, I actually saw that scene when I was younger because my sister loved Empire Records.
Yeah.
So I would catch little bits of it as a kid, and of course that scene stuck out to me as a 15-year-old. But even then, I was like, that's pretty far fetched.
Yeah, but like Gina, Renee Zellweger's character, like they could have just had that as like a scene, but then they turned it into this, you know, thing where Corey was really in love with Rex Manning, and then it turns into this like big sort of cat fight, and then you know, Corey almost has like an emotional breakdown.
Yeah. Oh, you know? and if it sounds like this all is very superficial, and there's no real stakes to it, that's because there's not.
No.
I mean, the movie's just really about these kids coming and going from the store. You know, it's all very like candy coated and superficial. It's not really that funny. And to me, the way the film is shot, because everything kind of has this like candy color sheen to it. It looks like I don't know if you remember this music video director from the 90s, but there was this guy named Mick G who made a lot of music videos in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Right.
Everything kind of looked like glossy rap videos.
Yeah.
No matter what the genre was.
Right.
It really looked like that a lot.
Yeah. There was a scene on the roof where the band's playing on the roof. There were like these big expensive crane shots, you know, of the street and of the front of the store. And, you know, it was just like everything was like sort of loud and boisterous. And, you know, it kind of felt like, you know, like I talked about in 18 again, where things just happen. Like there was no rhyme or reason why it was happening. And I know you're trying to get the idea of it's like a day in the life of a record store. So like everything is like, you know, you have a shoplifter. Like how do you deal with that? Like how do you deal with somebody who wants to kill themselves? Like, oh, let's have a mock funeral. I mean, the mock funeral to me is like they just stole that idea from the MASH movie.
Yeah.
But I mean,
yeah. Well, you mentioned the shoplifter. That's actually one of the few parts of the movie I liked.
All right.
Where Lucas sees a kid about to steal some CDs, and he chases after him. And it's a pretty fun little scene.
Yeah.
So they catch this kid who's like 13, 14.
Yeah.
And they bring him inside. They call the cops. But the kid hangs around for like a good 40 minutes in the movie, and they kind of bond with him.
Yeah. He becomes almost like a another, you know, employee of the store. Or
yeah,
whatever.
You can just play another one of the cast
because characters. Because he's just as sarcastic and witty as all the rest of them.
Yeah, which is completely unrealistic. They would not pal around with him. They would not get, you know, enamored with him. And then when the cops show up, they turn over to the cops, and the kid gets like, "I'll get you for turning me into the cops. I'll get you." And I'm like 5 minutes ago, you were palling around with these guys, man.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it just didn't make any sense. And then at the end of the film, the kid comes back.
Yeah.
With a gun.
Yeah. That was just superfluous.
And he's firing this gun off, and people are freaking out. And the guy who runs the store basically talks him down by offering him a job.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was like, I'm not going to swear, but I was like, screw this movie. This is the stupidest thing. No human being would act like this. They would get the gun away from this kid, and then they would beat him down. They would not offer him a job, and he would not become one of the crew.
Yeah. Well, the first 20 minutes for me, for the hardest part, when they introduced all the characters, it was just like, yeah. You could just tell all the characters are like super superficial, super pretentious. Yeah. And it was just like they all sort of seemed like self-absorbed, and it was all like that sort of like heady dialogue, yeah. Where it was like you could tell this was not written by people who actually listen to kids talk to each other.
It was written by someone who thinks they know what kids talk like.
Right, exactly.
Some guy who was our age at the time was like, I know what kids sound like.
Yeah. No, it felt all very sort of contrived, yeah. All of it. Now, once you try to get into it and you start, you know, the plot sort of start, all the little subplots start happening underneath, yeah. And, you know, even... like Debbie Mazar, is it Mazar?
I have no idea how to pronounce it. Sorry.
You know who I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
That plays Jane. She used to be like Madonna's dancer, or yes, like whatever, yes, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, and she plays an awesome role. I mean, loved her character, but like that's a whole subplot, like between her and Joe and all this other kind of stuff. So it's like, and you can tell there's a history there, but you don't know what it was. And
yeah.
But I just thought that it was, you know, and there's no real plot. The ending was like, wait, we have this thing where we have to make money. Okay, let's make a big party and have a band. And
they have the save the store moment,
yeah.
And it's all just very quickly thrown together. And it's, you know, it's all just slapdash. It really is.
It really is. With a bunch of music thrown in between, you know.
And, you know, not the best 90s music. You know? For a soundtrack, and I remember the soundtrack being very popular with people when I was a kid. I remember the soundtrack being everywhere when I was like a teenager.
Well, there was a lot more songs in the movie that are not on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
I mean, so there were songs from the 80s that were on there that, you know, were not on the soundtrack. But, I mean, the songs on the soundtrack were, I mean, this was supposed to be, like, it's got like Dishwalla and... You know the Evan Dando from the Lemonheads. You're just like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, you have to remember that, you know, from the mid 90s, like the alternative kind of got a little more softer for sure. You know what I mean?
It was not grunge grunge had been kind of balled up and was getting commercialized and it gotten softened. You're right. So you had all these kind of weaker kind of sounding alternative bands.
Yeah. Like the Gin Blossoms.
Yeah. The Gin Blossoms and like I said, Dishwalla, which I think is, if ever there was an idea of what a soft, terrible 90s band is, it's Dishwalla.
I agree.
You know, I'm sorry if the guys from Dishwalla are listening to this, but your band's not good.
Well, it's a very dated sound. You know what I mean? It's kind of like if you had to. Excuse me.
Brian's going through puberty, ladies and gentlemen. Forgive him.
You know, it would be like, you know, like they're a band kind of like, you know, the Atlanta Rhythm Section or something like that. Like if you want to say like 70s, you know, like they were from the era. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's so very quickly dated and almost none of the music on it's what I would call timeless.
Yeah.
And almost none of it's what I would consider. Anything that's, you know, even remotely sounds good now.
Yeah. Well, they had Gwar.
Gwar is an exception.
Okay.
But I like Gwar.
Well, we'll get into all the bands that were on the soundtrack. I mean, actually, since we're talking about music and film, I'll go ahead and mention them now.
Sure,
and not save them for the end. So Gin Blossoms, we mentioned the Cranberries, Edwin Collins. That's also Edwin Collins was one of these flash in the pan guys that had like one hit and like we never heard of him again.
The song listing is so 90s.
Yeah. Toad the Wet Sprocket, Better Than Ezra, Cracker, and Evan Dando. I mean, and those are the ones that people might remember from now. Yeah. There's a lot more artists that are on the soundtrack. And I was like, I don't know who that is. I've never heard this song. Maybe it's in the movie, but I'm like, I wouldn't recognize what it is. It wasn't that big of a hit, and nobody knows who they are now. I mean, there might be people out there listening to this podcast that might not know who Cracker is, but I would tell you, you need to go listen to, you know, Cracker, you know, they're a good band.
And I'll say this, I like Toad the Wet Sprocket, but I would not assume anyone else would like Toad the Wet Sprocket.
No, neither would I. And I, you know, I'm, you know, I love Toad the Wet Sprocket, but I have several of their albums. But yeah, it's like, I don't know if I was producing this movie, I would say, yeah, let's get this band for this movie. You know what I mean? It's not that kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know? But I think that at the time period, this is where, this is what I always felt like in the 90s, like people wanted to, in Hollywood and all of these industries wanted to cash in on like the grunge scene and the alternative scene.
It was really, this was the time period when
it's like a cash grab.
Well, it was the period when artistically it was very weak.
Yeah.
And a lot of those bands had sold out and become very commercial.
Yeah.
And it's just not a good, it was not a good period for music. It really wasn't.
No. Other bands that are in the movie but not on the soundtrack are Gwar, Dishwalla, The, like was or like an 80s band, Suicidal Tendencies, Throwing Muses, and Body Count, which has Ice-T as their lead singer. They're like a heavy metal band with like Ice-T as their lead singer.
I got to say, I like Suicidal Tendencies and Body Count. If they played more of that, I might have liked it more.
Yeah, right. But they're like bits and pieces of it. Like you hear it in the background when they're at the music store.
Yeah.
Which I thought was nice. I mean, I thought that every time they're in the store, you actually heard the music, you know, over the system, which is, you know, which is what would happen. Which I thought that was a part that I, you know, enjoyed.
Yeah.
But all the rest of it and the plot and...
Like, really, what I liked about the movie comes down to two things. There's a scene where they caught the shoplifter. I thought that was a fun sequence.
Right.
And any time where they stopped to dance.
Oh, right.
There were scenes where the employees would dance around with customers and almost in like a musical sort of way.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that because I like musicals.
Well, I think that's where... you get kind of the connections with the Breakfast Club come in.
Yeah.
You know, because the things that I liked about the movie were the fact of this is one of the few movies kind of like Clerks where the people that you work with, especially when you're young, become like your surrogate family.
Yes.
And it touches on that a lot. And that's what the whole movie is supposed to be about because it's supposed to be about these guys rallying to support one of their own, call him Rory because that's his real name, Rory Cochran, who plays Lucas. They want to support Lucas, who's in trouble, you know? So they all chip in their money. They contrive the idea of having the band come and, like, have, you know, people, and they charge money for beer and have a big party.
There's no emotional weight to any of it. Yeah.
So, yeah, and all the just the 90s, just... very cliche-ish, very, I meant pretentious.
Yeah, just, I would say, yeah, pretentious and obvious. Just so obvious.
Yeah. I do know that the popularity of this movie came about 10 years after, when more people were like, oh, this is like the younger generation that kind of remember some of these bands and remember people dressing this way, and they're like, this is how they think the 90s like were.
Yeah.
A lot like, you know, Dazed and Confused, or a lot like, you know, that 70s show or something like that, you know? Yeah. So.
And you don't realize how kind of just how forced it all is because they weren't there. They weren't old enough to really know what it was like.
Right.
They just have like vague, like spotty memories of what it was.
Right.
Unlike you and me who were the of the age of these characters
right
at the time. And we can see how kind of artificial it all is.
All right, well, let's move on.
Yes, let's.
Let's go to a much, much better movie.
I think it's a surprisingly great movie.
And this is a movie that a lot of people you may not have heard of. This is one of the few movies that is one of my absolute Probably one of my top 10 favorite movies. And I think part of it is because I grew up in a radio station. I in the 70s, I was born in the 70s. I went to the radio station with my dad. I saw a lot of this stuff. And even in the 80s and 90s, I was like, you know, he was the program director. He was program director for country radio, but it still had the same sort of idea of like the romantical idea of like being a DJ at a radio station.
Yeah.
And this is a film called FM that was released in 1978. And they're an FM radio station in Los Angeles, and they're a rock radio station. A lot of people, you know, you may or may not know, but FM was like very sort of like kind of like the long play format. You know what I mean? It was kind of like very slow. It was almost like PBS like, because only, you know, very, I don't know, what's the word, rich or could afford FM radios at that time.
It was kind of the upscale.
Yeah, very upscale.
Frequency.
And so when they started playing like rock music, it was because a lot of like stuff on FM was like classical and jazz. And then in the mid 70s, they started playing like rock. And it was kind of like, and they would play like whole albums, right? They would play like, oh, here's like a Guess Who record. And they'd play like the whole thing, you know, whatever. And then they started getting like DJs, like, you know, just like AM had DJs, you had FM DJs, but it was like the sultry side. It was like the, and I think this movie paints like the most realistic version of like what it is to be, to work at a radio station.
Well, and there's some interesting similarities between this and Empire Records. It's again, it's a very needle drop heavy movie.
Right.
There's music throughout the film,
right,
and it's very much about the day in the life of this business.
Yeah, I think it takes place over 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, but it's like kind of where you're kind of a fly on the wall almost.
Yeah,
kind of watching them go about what they do.
Right.
There's not really a narrative thing that kind of propulses the movie for the most part.
No.
There's a little bit of a plot, but really you're just kind of seeing events unfold.
Right.
With these disc jockeys in this radio station.
Right. The plot is kind of like it kind of bubbles up from underneath. So let's get into it. Let's just talk about like what happened. So, I mean, you open up the movie with the night DJ is getting off.
Played by Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles.
Plays the Prince of Darkness.
Which, what a great DJ name.
Yeah. What it is.
Yeah.
That's a terrible like
that's impression. That's his catchphrase that he says on the radio. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean. And what a great character to play, like this, like, you know, midnight to 6 a.m. DJ called the Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, just a super cool guy, you know.
Yeah. And he calls, like, you know, Jeff Dugan is the character's name, who's the program director and also the morning DJ.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, man, you got 5 minutes for this last song. He's like, you better be here.
Hey, you're late. Get in here.
Yeah. Or you got 5 minutes, you know, for the end of this record or whatever. And he goes, oh, okay. And then, like, you know, he jumps up and then hops, tails it through through the streets of L.A.
Yeah, he basically races to the station.
Yeah.
And tries to beat the record ending.
Yeah.
With this
German sports car, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally, totally awesome. And then makes it, you know, makes it in time.
Yeah, and is not winded or fazed by it. It's kind of just like that they're professionals, that they know what they're doing.
Right.
Everyone's just really, they're all really competent DJs. They're all charismatic and cool. It's really quite a cast of characters. Why don't you talk a little bit about the cast?
So Michael Brandon plays the program director, Jeff Dugan. Eileen Brennan plays a character called Mother. So she has like the evening shift, right? So, and Eileen Brennan, you might recognize her. She was played Mrs. Peacock in Clue.
Yeah. And she's got this sultry voice. And
his mother gonna put you down to bed.
Yeah. And she's the kind of and the older woman of the radio station. And she's like kind of the sultry, like she's the sultry night DJ.
Right.
Which is kind of a cliche when it comes to radio stuff, but she really pulls it off well.
Alex Karras plays Doc Holliday, who's kind of like the midday DJ, kind of plays like a, and see, that was the thing. Like, everybody kind of had their own personality.
Yeah.
So where Mother is kind of like, I feel your pain, you know, and Doc Holliday, he was just kind of a cowboy.
Yeah. And now he was also in Blazing Saddles. He played Mongo.
Yeah. And he was also the dad in Webster.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The TV show Webster.
Yeah, for 6 years, yeah, he played Webster's
yeah,
dad.
Yeah, he was like a football player for like turned actor, basically.
Yeah.
Martin Mull plays the like drive time DJ.
Yeah, the great Martin Mull.
Yeah, the great Martin Mull plays Eric Swan.
He's kind of this pretentious sort of like soft rock DJ.
Yeah, always looking at himself in the mirror. Yeah. Very
preening.
Sort of,
yeah. Yeah, kind of peacocking.
Yeah.
Talking about peace, love, and that kind of thing.
Right. Cassie Yates plays Lara Coe, which you see her a little bit. She plays like she replaces like Doc Holliday, basically. And Jeff brings her in because his, you know, Doc's ratings were really.
Yeah, that's just a little bit of the casual drama that happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that shows like not everything where everything in Empire Records like was like sort of positive. Like, you know, they had a shoplifter. Oh, they caught him or this happened or whatever. There was never any really horrible things that happened to any of them. Yeah. And they even got to tell like Rex Manning to get lost. FM, it kind of had a little bit of both. You had good things, but then you had bad things and how they dealt with it. Like, he had to fire one of his DJs.
Yeah, a guy he liked. And one thing, that's another difference between this and Empire Records. Nothing in Empire Records felt like it had any weight to it.
Yeah.
And here in FM, these little moments feel realer, so when this guy has to get fired, you feel bad. You actually have empathy for the characters as they're going through it.
Right. And Norman Lloyd plays Carl Billings, who plays, like, the owner. And then there's a couple other characters, like the sales guy who comes in and whatever, but you kind of get the idea of the DJs and the main cast of characters. Yeah. There's even like the engineer guy, like the nerdy engineer.
Yeah, he's
guy.
Kind of constantly he's like working on like the tech and wants to be a DJ.
Regis Lamar.
Yeah.
Tom Tarpley was that guy.
Yeah.
So yes, the music through the scenes. I mean, it was like so much like real life. Like, there's a scene where where Jeff Dugan goes to talk to. The cowboy guy.
Yeah.
And he goes in the booth because he hears like a bunch of stuff happening and he's like, hey, you all right? You okay? He plays a record. Then he goes back into the office and like you hear the music, you hear the same song. It never skips a beat.
Yeah.
But like you hear it change, you know, like you're in a different setting.
Yeah. Like you can tell it's in the speaker in the hallway and then it's the speaker in his office.
Yeah.
Like the sound design on it's actually really good.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a real radio station, and like the cart machine breaks down. The cart machine was like a loop of tape, and they used it to play commercials.
Yeah.
So you know, when the cart machine broke, like he had to go, okay, well, we're music free for the next hour.
Oh yeah,
or
we're commercial free.
Commercial
yeah.
free, or not music free. Mm-hmm. Commercial free. I mean, that stuff that was real life, you know, stuff that happened. I mean, that happened to me when I was on the radio. And then like you had Mother there, she had to like put up the carts, you know what I mean? Like that was a chore as a DJ. Yeah. Like once you played them, like you had to go put them all back. Like, you know, kind of showed the romantic part about it and the non-romantic part.
Yeah. Like if you wanted to know how a radio station worked, you would get a decent idea of it from watching this film. There's a lot of detail in it that make it feel real. Unlike Empire Records, which you would have no idea how a music store actually ran by watching Empire Records.
Right.
Could watch FM and get an idea of, well, okay, that's how a radio station at that time period worked.
Yeah, and there's a couple of concerts in the middle of it.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy Buffett comes and plays Louisiana Saturday Night.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about the film is it actually has kind of digressions where they're like, hey, we're going to go see this show tonight. And then you'll basically watch concert footage for a few minutes of these performers at the time.
Well, one of the subplots in the movie was the competing radio station is putting on, they're sponsoring the Linda Ronstadt concert.
Yeah.
Now, Linda Ronstadt was a huge star in the late 1970s.
Yeah, she's on the poster. That's how big of a star she was.
Yeah, she was. And so the sister station is going to do it, but Jeff Dugan figures out a way that he's going to get more attention out of it. Because he's going to talk to, like, the manager or whatever and broadcast the, you know, the show live on his radio station. And so, but he has to like get around it. He has to like, you know, get the other program director like lost.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminded me of that scene in Spinal
yeah,
Tap.
Where they can't find the stage. Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like the same stadium that they use.
Yeah.
It's really kind of
because the other radio station guy is kind of a blowhard and you don't like him. And, you know, he's kind of smug. So it's kind of a comeuppance moment for him to have these things taken away from him. Because there's not a whole lot of narrative conflict in the movie, at least at first.
No.
Eventually they get to a plot where they have this the sales agent come in from corporate who wants to get more commercial time on their station.
Yeah, so the idea is they have a big station, number one station, but it's not making any more money. And so Jeff, they wanna they hire in this sales manager, this hotshot sales manager, to come in and sell. So he brings in the Army. And the Army, like, this is the audience that they want. Like, they want young men, you know, 18 to 24 to go sign up, you know, and for the Army. Yeah. And they have these really dumb, kitschy, sounding, jingly commercials that Jeff's like, this is not going to fly. This is going to turn my audience off. This is going to turn them away.
Yeah. And they want them to play the commercials twice every hour. Something really excessive like that.
Right. And and he was like, what? No. You know, because he knew that it was going to alienate his core audience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, twice of any commercial in the same hour is really overkill for anything, really. But let alone something like the Army on a rock and roll station.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in radio, most of the national, most of the national commercials that were ran, ran once an hour. I mean, you hardly ever saw local commercials different, like for car lot or something like that. Yeah. You might run twice an hour. Certainly not like twice. I mean, and you're talking about, remember, we're talking about FM where they were like not used to, they probably only have two or three commercial breaks an hour. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the station was built on mostly music. That's why they had an audience.
Right.
And so they get into this conflict with the sales manager.
Yeah.
And Dugan ends up getting fired or quitting.
Yeah, because it's kind of like, no, I'm not going to play him. No, he delays like giving his feedback to the sales manager about it.
Yeah.
Then when he finally does, the sales manager then has to go to, you know, his higher up. And the that guy says, you know, I'll take care of Dugan. You know, you just tell the Army you got a deal. So then you're going to have a standoff, right, where it's like you play the commercials or you can go take a hike.
Yeah.
And Dugan decides to take a hike, you know, and it all kind of comes to a head. But so the DJs decide, well, we're going to take the station hostage and we're not going to let them, you know, just do whatever they want to with the station. You know, this station belongs to the fans and it belongs to us.
And so they get on the air and they talk about what's going on and they draw a big crowd down to the station. Yeah. It causes kind of a riot. And, the actual owner of the station finds out about it through the news and is like, and basically he eventually ends up agreeing with the DJs and they all live happily ever after.
Well, he agrees with the DJs because he sees what kind of power that these fans have and how much they love and how much that Jeff Dugan is able to whatever he's doing is the right, you know. Yeah.
It's all kind of fairy tale-ish.
Yeah.
You know? But it's a very small part of the movie, but it works because, again, unlike Empire Records, I have to keep comparing and contrasting. You end up liking all these characters by hanging out with them in kind of a casual way and seeing them through their lives over these couple of days. You grow to like them all.
Well, and once again, you have this surrogate family.
Yeah.
Who comes together at the end to take care of one of their own. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this time, it's not like taking care of another DJ. It's like taking care of our main guy.
Yeah.
Like, this is the guy this is the glue that, like, keeps everything together. Like, we wouldn't be here and be able to do our jobs if he wasn't, like, keeping everything running.
Yeah.
Because he is. He really, like, is involved with, like, all of the stuff. I mean, he's really plays the you know, manager, you know, the program director, manager, well, you know.
Yeah. And they really illustrate how much he cares about them, how much he cares about the station and the listeners. The movie does a really good job of, you know, endearing all these characters to you.
Yeah.
So, again, that's where Empire Records fails, is like, it has the same kind of Shaggy Dog quality, But FM does a much better job of making you care about these casual interactions.
So let's just talk about the music.
Yes.
that is in FM. Steely Dan, they actually have three songs. So there's FM. They wrote the main theme, which is a song called FM. FM reprise, and I think like Do It Again. As I think I don't remember what I'd have to look it up. But they have, three songs on the soundtrack. Bob Seger, Steve Miller Band, Foreigner, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, The Eagles, Boz Scaggs, Boston, Linda Ronstadt, Jimmy Buffett, Dan Fogelberg, Billy Joel, The Doobie Brothers, James Taylor, Joe Walsh, and Queen. Now, I guarantee you can turn on any classic rock station anywhere in the country, and you're going to hear one of those acts within the hour. Yes.
And it is almost like listening to a classic rock station. One thing that's interesting about the film is a lot of these songs are actually played almost in full throughout the movie. So it's almost like watching a movie set to an actual radio station that's playing classic rock.
And like you were saying, like some of the songs actually, like the tone or whatever, you know, that's in it is about whatever's happening at the time. Yes. You know, like when Martin Mull, his character, Eric Swan, he finds out like his manager is like firing him, you know, because he did a horrible job at like being, you know, to himself.
He had a bad audition. Yeah.
Yeah. At this audition for a game show. So he's like, you're fired. You made an embarrassment out of me. Then he also realizes that his girlfriend is gone.
Yeah.
So, and then he plays a song that's like this really sort of like sad, you know, sort of breakup song. Yeah. You know?
Or when Dugan quits, they play Breakdown by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, because Tom Petty. Okay, so the appearances of bands, REO Speedwagon has an appearance. They don't play and they don't have a song on soundtrack, but they're in the movie signing autographs at the local record store. As themselves. Tom Petty plays himself. Yeah. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers are there to do an interview at the radio station.
So they're playing the song because they're promoting that record. But the song that's playing in the foreground while this is happening in the background actually fits the mood of this dialogue-less scene that's happening in the background of basically the station management falling apart.
Well, that was one of the thoughts that I thought was like the most the kind of the faults of the film, the dialogue-less scenes. Let's talk about that for a second. Because there were two. There were two pivotal moments. There was one where Dugan kind of talks Eric Swan off the ledge.
Yeah.
Because after, just like I said, the scene where he's, you know, heartbroken, he gets on the air and starts like, he locks himself in the studio and has like, starts crying and starts talking about the sob story. Yeah.
And he's like, is there true love for a man like Eric Swan?
It's all this self-loathing and, you know,
And Martin Mull crushes it. It's so subtly funny.
Yes.
Because he's so melodramatic. And you see like women gathering out front of the station,
about ready to break the door down. Yeah.
And at one point, Dugan forces his way into the.
Well, they cut him off the air.
Yeah, they cut him off the air. Yeah, and Dugan forces his way into the booth.
Yeah, but you hear the song playing in the background while this is happening. Yeah. And then they have a conversation.
Yeah.
But you can almost tell what they're talking about. You know, while they're talking. You know?
He's trying. He's like, I understand. I know you're hurting. I'm your friend. I'm here for you. You know, they hug and have a little moment.
And he's like, you can't do this. You know, you're Eric Swan. You know, Eric Swan doesn't do this kind of thing.
And then there's this one of the moments actually made me really laugh in the movie. Yeah. And then you can see him kind of tell. He tells Eric Swan.
So once they hug each other, they give each other kind of like a crying sort of hug.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, wait, I got to tell you, there's a whole bunch of women waiting for you. You know?
And immediately Martin Mull kind of straightens himself up and like goes back into peacock mode.
Yeah, starts brimming himself up and like, is my hair okay? You know, it's like flipping a switch, man. Yeah. It's like,
and
man.
He walks out like he's a rock star into the lobby where all the women are screaming for him. And they're holding the door shut so they don't rush in. And he's like, well, open the doors. And he goes out into this throng of people. And it's not funny the way I'm describing it, but it's played so well. And it's such a fun little scene.
Yeah.
Again, the movie is so likable.
Yeah.
You really see, I keep up on this. You like every character.
You like every character. You absolutely do. I think you fall in love with all of them. And even, you know, as melodramatic as like Mother is, you know, she quits and then she comes back. And, You know, when she comes back for Dugan, I mean, that shows you how much they like him. Yeah. So, yeah, there's so much to this movie I just love so much. Not just the music, but just how it's portrayed and how realistic that it's portrayed. Yeah. And I think that it wasn't a very popular movie, and I think that maybe because it is so sort of realistic, but then there's also it's still a movie, so you still have to be outlandish about a couple of things.
Yeah, I mean, and it got definitely near in the 70s that there was this real strive for realism. Mm-hmm. And the movie definitely dabbles in that. Like, at times it feels like, again, like almost like you're watching a documentary at times.
Yeah.
And it has a few kind of outlandish comic moments to remind you that, oh, yeah, this isn't real. But it has kind of that kind of gritty 70s naturalism.
Definitely.
And it couldn't be farther from the candy-coated surrealism of Empire Records.
Right.
They're so similar. They're so similar in ways, and so very, very different in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, one thing I'll say about this movie, you know, when we started this podcast, my hope as a guy who loves movies,
right,
a guy who watches a lot of movies and writes about movies, I'd hope that I would find a movie that I had not heard of, had never seen,
right,
that I really, really liked,
right.
And, you know, I've seen some that I thought were pretty good.
Right.
None I really just fell in love with until now. Right. I don't mean to overhype it, but I really was blown away by this movie because I never heard of it until you suggested it.
Right.
I never would have watched it otherwise.
Right.
And I really like it.
Well, that is truly, truly awesome. And I really love that that you love the music. I know a lot of the music, you know, classic rock, it isn't really your total bag. You know what I mean? But I mean, you know, I know I don't see you jamming to like Steely Dan.
I do love some Joe Walsh.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And I never would have thought I would have liked Linda Ronstadt, but those scenes with Linda Ronstadt are pretty great.
Man, she was the stuff back then. That's like Linda Ronstadt in her prime, man.
That's one thing I'll say. Even if you heard him list off the bands and you're like, okay, some of those bands I don't necessarily like or know anything about, the music in this movie is really great.
Yeah.
It's like a real time capsule of this period of time. So again, it's just as alien as the music story is nowadays. The idea of, you know, the FM station with all this classic rock. I mean, there's not really much of those around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie is such a time capsule of a time period and a certain sound and a vibe.
Yeah.
That even if you don't think, if you heard the list of bands, you heard the list of actors, and you think, I don't know if I would like that, I would say still give it a chance, because you'll be surprised how great those songs are and how good the performances are in this movie.
Oh, man. It's fantastic. And I will say on the soundtrack, the live performances are on the soundtrack. So if you have the CD or the cassette or the vinyl, the full live performances, like the one song by Jimmy Buffett, and the three songs by Linda Ronstadt. She does an awesome version of Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, it's a great cover.
Oh, my God. I mean, so great. And then she also does Warren Zevon's song, Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me.
Yeah, that's an all-time great song.
Yeah, and then she does, like, Love Me Tender.
Yeah, if you have a passing interest, even just a passing interest in classic 70s rock, this is the movie and soundtrack you really got to check out.
And I mean, in hi-fi enthusiasts as well. Yeah. I mean, this is a hi-fi movie. I mean, anybody who loves any of those bands that I just mentioned, you would totally love this movie, yeah. I think. So, if you went to go see the Queen movie, you know,
I think
you would love this movie.
Wasn't this the first movie to ever feature Queen on a soundtrack?
Yes, it was.
I thought so.
But that's not in my notes, by the way.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was the first Queen song featured in a film.
Yeah, because based on the time period, it had to have been. I can't think of any other examples where they would have been before that. So that had to be. I thought it had to be the first one.
Right.
So yeah, that touched right there.
It probably is for a lot of these acts. I mean, probably is for Tom Petty. I mean, Tom Petty only had like one album out at this time. So.
And again, I want to say, if you're a Tom Petty fan, it's really nice to see Tom Petty show up in this for a few moments.
Oh man, I mean, totally. Yeah. So missed that guy. Yeah. It's tragic.
I got a little choked up still. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's only two movies that he's in, I think. This one, and he was in,
he's in The Postman with Kevin Costner.
The Postman. Yeah. I was going to say Waterworld, but no, it's The Postman.
Yeah. He wasn't anything. I don't know if he wasn't anything else. No. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but this he plays himself, and yeah. it's
him in the 70s. He's just cool yeah. and young, and it's just nice to see him, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, and he was really kind of an unknown at that
time. He was. I mean, that yeah. was his first record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the facts and the fun stuff.
Hit me.
All right. So we already talked about Empire Records has been compared to movies such as Car Wash, The Breakfast Club, and Clerks. And I never really thought about Car Wash until
Car Wash is great.
I know Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's like we'll focus on that. A bonus recommendation. Watch Car Wash. Track it down. George Carlin, Richard Pryor.
Yes.
It's a great movie.
Great, great movie. And I think, and also kind of like the same thing, like kind of a day in the life of the
of a car wash, yeah.
We talked about the soundtrack. We talked about the other bands. The exteriors were filmed in 15th South Front Street in Wilmington, North Carolina. Debbie Mazar, we mentioned her before. She also played a cameo role as Anthony LaPaglia's date in So I Married an Axe Murderer in 1993.
I forgot he was in So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah, you forget that he's his buddy or whatever. He plays this cop buddy. But they were like, he's an Australian actor, by the way. Yeah. But yeah, like just a few years before they were together in that movie. The Rex Manning music video to the song Say No More, Mono More. It was supposed to be just like a really quick like flash thing, but the guy that they hired to shoot it just decided, I'll just make a full video. And so there is a full 4 minute and 30 second video of the song.
Sounds like torture.
It was featured on one of the DVDs. You can probably find it on YouTube if you really want to watch it.
I don't.
The film was severely edited in post-production, removing three significant characters and up to
three characters. There's already so many characters in the movie.
I know one of the characters was the guy, the kid, the shoplifter, like his sister, like somehow gets involved at one point.
Yeah. There's like 15 people who work at this store and they cut out three other characters. That's amazing to me.
I know. And with four, it was originally wasn't supposed to be one whole day. It was supposed to be a couple of days.
Yeah.
So that's why.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that explains part of why it feels so, you know, slapdash.
Right. It was condensed from occurring over 2 days to a single day. In the 2003 Special Fan Edition DVD, they added four extra scenes, totaling 16 minutes of additional footage. And also included the full music video. The 2015 Blu-ray version has the theatrical cut. So from what I read and what I've like looked at what fans like really wanted, they actually like the theatrical cut version.
That's what I've heard, is that they like the theatrical version. I didn't like the movie, so the idea of watching 16 more minutes of it.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, not the full 40-minute extra version, but the 16 minutes.
But even the idea of 16 more minutes of this is just more than I want to deal with, you know? Yeah.
According to the Billboard article, okay, so this is kind of like where this might explain a little bit of the film and kind of like its production and post-production and all that kind of stuff. The plan from like Regency was to release Empire Records to 1,215 theaters by September 22nd of 1995. Regency decided at the last minute to test the films on teen audiences in the San Fernando Valley. So, you know, usually when they do test audiences, it's like they do like one or two nights or one or two shows.
Yeah.
And then they kind of get get feedback from the people afterwards. And the people in the kids in San Fernando Valley in this like, you know, predominant, you know, like very affluent suburban neighborhood, they loved it. So they're like, okay, we're all great. But there's somebody up there going, yeah, I don't know. Maybe some executives like, I don't think so. So because this was a big budget movie. This was their teen movie of that year. So they didn't want to blow it. So they said, let's test it in a lower class Hispanic neighborhood. And I mean, I can just tell you the results were terrible.
Because
they couldn't relate to the audience at all. How are they going to relate to them?
They aren't real people in the film at all.
Right.
They're kind of bratty, pretentious, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, of course. So What did Regency do? Instead of 1,000 plus screens, they pulled it back. Instead of 1,250, they pulled it back to 57 or 87.
Huh.
87 theaters. No national advertising campaign. The soundtrack only, no premiere. The soundtrack only had like two hit singles at the time, but almost no tie-ins to the movie. Like the video, you know, the MTV videos didn't have like anything about clips, the movie.
Clips, which were a thing, yeah.
Yeah, because that's how people like, you know, like, oh, well, I was going to see this movie, was in this video. Well, yeah, it's got to be cool then. And then the Warner Brothers yanked it after 2 weeks. And it only made the total gross. Are you ready? Now, this is a time where budgets, they didn't really release like what they were.
It's not like it is now where it's all
I would say, death. I would put it around, what would you guys? I'm going to say about $11 million.
I would guess anywhere from 10 to 15.
Okay. So we're about right. Which I would think, I don't know what the actual figures were. Some executive probably does. But the total gross... 303,000.
See, I want to say...
But that's, remember, it's only 87 screens or whatever, and that's only like after 3 weeks.
Yeah, so I guess it was entirely... I mean, because my memory is messing with me, because I could have sworn it came out in theaters, but I grew up in a small town, so that must not have. It must have only been like a home video kind of
thing. It was. Yeah. That's the thing, is like it basically almost might as well been direct-to-video.
Yeah.
Because... how else is anybody going to find out about this movie? I remember seeing it in the video store and seeing Liv Tyler on the front and saying, like, when did this movie come out? How did I miss this?
Because she was the girl from the Cry-In video.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, she's in a movie?
Yeah. She was a big deal.
Yeah. So, and there's like, yeah, she takes her sweater off.
Yeah.
Well,
we were teenagers, people. Just
sorry.
Just to say.
Sorry.
You know.
Back to reality.
Yeah.
Roger Ebert.
Hated it.
Of course. Gave it 1.5 stars.
Oh, good for you, Roger.
If the movie is a lost cause, it may be at least showcase actors who have better things ahead of them.
I don't think anything went on to do anything really all that great except for Liv Tyler. And well, Renee Zellweger.
Yeah. He's basically like, well, the cast was good.
Yeah.
Rotten Tomatoes gave it 29% from critics. 84% audience. 84%!
Yeah, people like this movie.
They love this movie.
Yeah. I know many people who love it. I mean,
yeah. Oh, I also forgot. I had it in here. There's Rex Manning Day. We talked about Rex Manning Day. When you first see Corey... you know, she says, well, it's Rex Manning Day. Rex Manning Day is an actual day because they talk about the day that, you know, for some reason, the day somehow in the movie gets mentioned. And it's April 8th. So the date appears somewhere in the film. So that's why if you ever see on Twitter on April 8th, why Rex Manning Day is trending, this is why.
The movie has fans. I am not one of them.
Well, that's what I said. I think the movie now kind of has a second life as what people think the 90s movie, what the 90s was really.
Yeah.
Which, you know, whatever. FM, let's move on. I didn't find a lot of information about any of these movies.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, FM was not a pop, was not a popular film, so I doubt there's much information on it out there.
Well, we have to talk about the kind of the elephant in the room about FM.
Okay, what's that?
It is often believed to be the inspiration for the TV show WKRP in Cincinnati.
That's what I always thought when I did learn about it. What I kind of assumed.
Right.
Is that not the case?
But in fact, the pilot for that show for WKRP was filmed before the FM's release.
So it was kind of just similar concepts at the same time from different people.
Both were built around a radio station in Los Angeles, a rock radio station called KMET, and their program director, Michael Hunter. So both Jeff Dugan and the character Jeff Dugan in WKRP whose name was Andy Travis.
Andy Travis, yeah.
Who looked very similar to like Dugan. So, although Andy Travis was clean shaven and yeah. had a beard.
I tell you, the cast of WKRP looks pretty similar to the cast of FM. It's
yeah.
It's kind of surprising that they were two independent projects of each other.
Right. And you also had similar characters. Like we had instead of, you know, Eric Swan, you know, you had Dr. Johnny Fever.
Yeah, and even the personality-wise, they weren't alike. Visually, they bear a resemblance to each other.
Right, and then instead of, you know, the Prince of Darkness, you had
Venus Flytrap.
Venus Flytrap. So, yeah, I mean, similar sort of characters. Now, there was other characters WKRP added, yeah. like Les Nessman and then, yeah. like...
But he was kind of a dorky salesman, like the dorky salesman FM.
Yeah, exactly. It was always like asking girls on dates and, you know, yeah. like, get away from me, you creep.
Yeah, I guess he just must have been like the kind of the Armageddon Deep Impact kind of Dante's Peak and Volcano sort of, you know, just dual project thing where they just happen to have overlap.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, so it is kind of... So, yeah, it is very sort of similar of the era. So you kind of get the idea. And actually, matter of fact, in my notes, the WKRP creator, Hugh Wilson, asserts the sitcom was already in development when the film came out, and he was scared to death when the movie came
out. I'm sure, because what if it was a hit?
Yeah. He was afraid the movie was going to eclipse the actual show. Which the show made its debut in September of 1978. So they're almost like kind of coincided with each other.
Yeah.
Because this movie was released in like April of 78, and then like the TV show was released in September.
And I gotta say, if you like WKRP in Cincinnati, I guarantee you'll like FM.
Yes, definitely. Steely Dan's No Static at All song won engineers, Al Schmidt and Roger Nichols, the 1979 Grammy Award for Best Engineered Recording for Non-Classical. Some radio stations recut the song and inserted an A for AM in the song, like AM, no static at all.
Yeah.
Tom Petty's Hard Promises in 1981. So this is a weird thing. This is kind of like where life... life imitates art kind of thing. His record label wanted to increase the price of his album in 1981, his album called Hard Promises, to $9.89 versus $8.98. And he was like, no, I'm not going to do this, and I will not release my album if that's what you're going to do. And fans stood up, you know, with him. So it's very similar to like where FM, where they're like, no, we're not going to do
this. We're not going to compromise for this. Yeah, right.
So, yeah, this is where I thought was kind of interesting.
It's pretty cool, man.
The movie, now speaking of Tom Petty, the movie was released in April 20 of 1978. So the Breakdown song was released on their self-titled debut album, which came out in 1976. So it actually came out like 2 years before the movie came out. So, but I think, the new album... called You're Gonna Get It, which was their second album, was released on May 2nd, 1978, which would have been like more in line with the film. So, because usually artists come to radio stations to talk about like their latest album or their latest release. Well, I think, you know, and the hits off that album were songs that you may know called I Need to Know and Listen to Her Heart.
Yeah.
So, Breakdown is on the film soundtrack, but I think what gives it kind of a pass, at least in my eyes, is that Tom Petty, like, the question that they ask him is, like, being on the road or being on tour or something like that.
And also, thematically, it fits with the film and what happens in the film. I think it was a conscious choice to choose that song because it fits so well in the context of the movie.
But if it were made at, like, a later time, they wouldn't have chose a previous released, you know, song. They would have chose, like, a new album to kind of coincide with the release, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But... alas, I mean, I don't really have a problem with that at all. It's just kind of one of those interesting things I thought I would mention.
Yeah.
The Q Sky FM frequency is listed in the movie as 108.1. That is basically impossible in the United States because The frequency band only goes to like 107.9.
Sort of like the 555 phone number thing you see in movies where there's no phone numbers that begin with 555.
Yeah.
I guess it's the key from you don't want to accidentally give free advertising to your radio station somewhere. Yeah,
and they wouldn't be called QSky. Radio stations in the United States either start with a W or a K. So they would never start with a Q anyway. So that was another thing that they didn't want to be. There is, I think, a WKRP TV station. It's not in Cincinnati, but... But yeah, I mean, they didn't want to kind of give advertising or confuse another radio station with their. So, this next bit of trivia, I actually added myself to IMDb.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, well,
because there was not a lot of trivia. So, but in watching the film, I decided, okay. That's a little bit of trivia. It's interesting to me because I'm a technical guy.
Okay. Well, let's hear it.
The microphones in the movie in the main booth are stereo AKG C414 microphones, and the speakers that you see are JBL 4311s. So, there.
And that's why Ryan does all the technical stuff for our podcast right there.
Yeah, also the turntables are model Technics SP10s, and the other hi-fi gear that I saw, I don't know the actual model numbers because I didn't really research them that quick. Somebody probably knows what the model numbers are if they look at them. But there's a Marantz receiver, and also in Jeff Dugan's office, like, in the thing, you see a SAE amplifier and a SAE EQ. SAE, back in the day, that was really like top-of-the-line stuff. So when they showed that, they made sure that they got that like in the shot. You know what I mean? That's also very unique for FM stations to have like two microphones. It is a little bit weird. Yeah. But I think that from the time period, it would have been normal because – FM at that time really wanted to show off their like stereo sound, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they were also the most successful radio station in the area, so they probably had better gear than a lot of the other ones.
Yeah, I mean C414s you won't see in most radio stations even today. Even you know what I mean? You mostly see that they're mostly like vocal microphones. I mean there's probably some soundtrack. There's probably some movies on the soundtrack that have C414s, you know,
yeah,
to record either vocals or instruments or something. And there also, this has no word on, I couldn't find any information as far as like budget or sales figures, box office figures.
I just know that the movie was not as successful as the soundtrack. Soundtrack actually did pretty well, much better than the actual movie.
But had a lot of like really good songs. I mean,
yeah.
Steve Miller Band is like, you know, Fly Like an Eagle on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not just like a throwaway B-side. You know what I mean? You know, Boss Skaggs put like, you know, the Lido Shuffle. I mean, that's one of his top hits.
Yeah.
You know, Queen put, we talked about Queen. I mean,
We Will Rock You.
Yeah, We Will Rock You is on. I mean, that's a huge hit. I mean, so there's, it's the soundtrack. It's a double album, okay? Yeah. It's two records. I have the soundtrack.
Which we'll show on Twitter, I imagine, when this comes out.
I almost brought it in to show you. Yeah. It's so cool. But anyway.
Yeah. I'm sure you're going to take photos, and we're going to show it off on social media.
Yeah. What do you think, Rotten Tomatoes? What do you think?
I'm going to guess... Let me think.
Remember, Empire Records was 29 critics.
I'm going to guess 50.
22.
Oh, come on.
22. This is bullshit.
It's, well, here's the thing.
Sorry. I'm sorry, Chris. It really is.
I could see at the time why critics may think.
But these are modern critics.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what they said in a second, but go ahead.
Well, okay. I can see why critics at the time may not have liked it because it is rambling. It doesn't have a lot of narrative propulsion. But watching it now 40 years after it came out, because it's been about 41 years, I believe.
Right.
Now it becomes like this really, again, I used the phrase earlier, but like a really cool time capsule of a period of time that is so different from where we are today that it's really interesting and kind of nice to go back to, like the music, the clothes, just, you know, the entire atmosphere. It becomes like this little time capsule of what life was like in 1978.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the critics faulted it for. So the same reason that you're celebrating how great this movie is. You know, they said, you know, it's completely of the period, or, you know.
Well, I think, see, sometimes that can really hurt a film. Like, you know, I think that's what really hurts Empire Records. But if it's done in a natural, if it feels a way that feels natural, it's okay and can be lauded and appreciated. Like, to me, it doesn't feel like they're trying to be overly 70s. You know, they're not wearing, like, disco outfits and, you know, you know, sparkly boots.
Yeah.
It feels like very natural 70s fashion, very natural 70s setting.
Right.
It goes back to that whole kind of natural style of 70s filmmaking.
Right.
And see, to me, it just felt very... and again, I'm not from... I was born in 79. Mm-hmm. This was before my time. But it feels authentic.
Right.
You know? It feels, again, it feels almost like, again, it has documentary-like aspects to it, mm-hmm. which I appreciated. So I think they're wrong.
Well, here's what one guy said, okay? Keith Phillips or Keith Phipps of AV Club writes, and I'm sorry.
The AV Club.
You know where I'm going.
Yeah, I'm probably going to get trouble because it's going to be recorded. The AV Club doesn't like anything.
It gets the standard rock movie formula backwards by trying to base a revolution around some of the safest, least revolutionary music in the history of rock.
Yeah, you say that now through 21st century eyes. You got to think about at the time it was made.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I know Linda Ronstadt was a big star at the time. Jimmy Buffett is, you know, like a safe bet. I mean, God, his parrot heads, like, you know, will pack theaters and auditoriums across, you know, the world almost.
But was that true in 78?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, in Steely Dan, I mean, the only people I know that really listen to Steely Dan are like hi-fi guys, you know what I mean? Like...
They had some good songs, man.
Yeah, they have some good songs. I mean, I like their music. I mean, I don't listen to it all the time. I mean, I love Tom Petty. And,
Well, to me, that review, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because this podcast is not about that guy and his writing. It sounds like he wanted it to be like the decline of the Western civilization, you know, that documentary about punk rock in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
It's not that, man. It's a commercial mainstream movie meant to entertain. And the fact that it doesn't give an essence of a revolution because they play Joe Walsh music, get over yourself, man. You know, come on. That to me, that reeks of someone wanting to just bury it because they didn't think it was hip.
I agree. Well, it has a 67% audience score, which is still a little bit lower than Empire Records. I mean, Empire Records, what'd I say? 84?
To me, that makes sense well, because some people just don't like watching things that seem old. Like, if it seems too much of a time period, some people just mentally check out.
Yeah, that's true, too.
And this movie feels very much like the 70s.
It does. I think it captures... I mean, and I don't, like I said, I don't think it's just the 70s. I think it captures... It really gives you the ups and downs of, you know, what it was like in a FM radio station. I mean, it's just, it hits so many marks for me. And, you know, from somebody who came from, you know, radio, who was, you know, in a radio station in the 70s, you know, of that, I think it is the most true sort of representation that you'll ever see. You know, of what it is in a radio station.
Well, and I think time has been kind to it, and critical response doesn't necessarily indicate popularity. Because as I told you last week, and we're going to date this podcast a little bit, but just last week, FM was announced to get a special edition Blu-ray from a boutique Blu-ray label called Arrow Video. And so that means it's going to be, you know, this is a company that puts out a lot of special edition movies of different titles.
Yeah,
and so
high def,
and so then that means there has to be a demand for it. They wouldn't just put out FM to put it out,
right.
They have to realize that people want it.
Yeah,
it's going to have special features, remastered video and audio.
Yeah,
I mean it's going to be
wait.
It's going to be a nice addition. Movies like that, they know if it was truly hated, they wouldn't have put that much money into it.
Yeah, I think it was until the mid to late 2000s where it even got put out on DVD. I mean, I found, I couldn't find it anywhere. I found, you know where I found FM the first time when I bought it? I found it in like a grocery store in like where the bin, there were like these VHS tapes for like, you know, $3 or something like that. I mean, that's where I got my VHS copy.
Yeah,
in like the probably 1998 or 1999.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, I'm glad the Blu-ray is coming out because the DVD is going for a crazy amount on the secondary market. I actually looked it up just out of curiosity. The DVD on Amazon is going for about $80.
Is it really? Holy crap. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the Blu-ray will come out, and of course, the Blu-ray will become, the way to buy it.
I mean, that just shows you, like, what kind of demand there is for, like, a really, like, better copy of it.
Yeah, the people who want it, you know?
Yeah, because it wasn't produced by, like, some big studio, like, back in the day.
I think it was it Universal? I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But it wasn't a big hit, I think it's definitely built an audience over the years.
Well, and like I said before to you, it also might have been, you have to realize the sync licenses that go into all of these songs.
That's
you know what I mean?
That's kind of amazing that it's getting a remastered edition, which will probably be close to coming out by the time this podcast actually comes out.
Yeah, hopefully so.
It'll be probably within weeks of it coming out.
Yeah.
But think about having to clear all those licensing rights to get all these songs in this movie.
Yeah, because every time there's a new format, there has to be new rights, you know, for that version or whatever.
So that goes back to, again, there must be a demand, because why wouldn't they go through the hassle of clearing all those songs if they didn't think they could sell it?
Yeah, and like really popular songs too. I mean,
especially now with Queen being what they are.
And even they have to sign off on the performances, you know, like Tom Petty and Linda Ronstadt and all that. And Jimmy Buffett, like he has to sign off on that. You know?
Yeah. So I think that's indicative that the movie is more well liked than it's indicative that the movie is more well liked than those numbers say it is, because they would not go through that much trouble to remaster it, put it out, commission new artwork for the cover,
right,
and all that stuff if it wasn't a well liked movie, because it's not something you can just pull out and say, oh, we're going to buy the rights to this and throw it out there.
Right,
it's going to be a bells and whistles kind of thing.
All right. Well, let's go through our. I think we've talked it out. I think we we agree.
Well,
let's. We love. What would we do? You know, would you keep? Okay. So, do you ask the question or I ask the question?
It's okay. This is still kind of a fuzzy thing that we do here. Okay, if we were to rent this movie, if we were to rent Empire Records,
okay,
would you keep it an extra day or would you get it back to the video store early to avoid the late fees?
I don't know. I have love-hate relationship with this movie, but I'd probably give it back.
I would drive by the video store really fast and throw it into that that outside slot thing they used to have. Remember those where you just kind of drop it off and keep going? I wouldn't even slow down. I would just kind of throw it out the side of my window.
Oh, my God.
And hope it landed in the slot.
Oh, my God. I have an interesting story about that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one day about how a snowstorm like broke that slot because the video store was closed. Video store worked there. Anyway, so I would probably return it.
Okay. Well, what about FM?
I'm keeping it, man. I own it on VHS and on Laserdisc, and I'm gonna own the Blu-ray when it comes out.
So not only do you have to take a photo of your LP of it, you gotta take a photo of your Laserdisc and you gotta put those together in like a montage photo.
Yeah.
For social media.
I might even have it on DVD. I can't remember. I'll have to look.
Well, now it'd be the time to flip it free when realizes the Blu-ray comes out.
I better.
Yeah, I would go on Amazon and see what you can do for sending it in for store credit.
eBay, here I come.
Yeah. I mean, I would keep FM an extra day. Like I like the movie a lot. I'm going to buy that Blu-ray when it comes out.
I'm definitely buying.
I'm going to pre-order it.
All right. So, movie suggestions.
Okay. Well, watching the concert footage in FM reminded me of one of the all-time great concert films.
Mm-hmm.
That's Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz.
Oh, my God.
I know that's two Scorsese. Oh, yeah. That's two Scorsese recommendations in two episodes. But he's one of our great filmmakers.
Yeah.
The Last Waltz is about supposedly the last concert by the legendary group The Band.
Yeah, that was Levon Helm. You know, the band, you know, up on Cripple Creek. And they played Was it Carnegie Hall? Like multiple nights or whatever.
Yeah. They had Muddy Waters.
Eric Clapton.
I believe Dylan was there with them too.
Dylan was. Yeah. That's how they got called the band. Yes. Was they were the backing band for Dylan. Mm-hmm. Who was it? George Harrison.
It's probably the all-time greatest concert film.
I would agree.
It is beautiful. The music is transcended. If you can see it on a big screen, occasionally they do those Fathom events where you can see old movies in the theater again.
Right.
Or if you have like a local art house that does shows old movies, usually about once a year, The Last Waltz plays in a theater somewhere in your area. Track it down, watch it big if you can, loud. It's a wonderful concert film.
Yeah. Well, we talked about in the kind of like the pre-show production, what movies we were going to suggest. And we're like, well, FM is a great, you know, sort of movie from the showcases of music from the 70s. You know, Empire Records has a lot of, you know, stuff from the 90s. What about the 80s? Is there one in the 80s?
We really racked our brains over this.
No, I mean, because really the formula for the 80s was just like, well, have a hit song that we can tie into the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot like... that you had Beverly Hills Cop or Top Gun.
Or it's Huey Lewis in the News. It's The Power of Love.
Or
you know, stuff like that. You know?
So we couldn't really, you know, think of any, but there were other movies I think that had great soundtracks, like The Breakfast Club, which I think also relates well that we talked about the rest of the tie-ins to the movie.
And it kind of fits in that thing of being a movie with a lot of needle drops. It kind of works for the 80s. Right. It's kind of got a Shaggy Dog narrative again, where there's not really a lot of plot propulsion, but you're just hanging out with the characters. So that kind of works.
And there's like dancing scenes.
Yeah.
There's music. And there's also Some Kind of Wonderful, which was a John Hughes film. Pretty in Pink was another John Hughes film. St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah.
They're all those types of the films that, I mean, that just kind of had music like in the background as part of the thing.
Basically, if you wanted to make a triple feature, you could slot any of those movies into the middle section. And I think thematically they would work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree. And I think if you were to go backwards to the 60s, I think a movie that fits in very well, which also, features, FM radio DJ, or not really FM, more like AM, popular radio DJ, Wolfman Jack, was George Lucas's American Graffiti.
And with that, you've got yourself a good little like film festival day of programming there. Yeah.
I know, man. What if you watch like American Graffiti, then you watch like FM, and then you watch like The Breakfast Club, and then you watch like Empire Records?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that they would all kind of flow into each other pretty well.
And then you just threw in The Last Waltz, like at the end, just to like recover from all of that.
To end on a high note, of kind of a mellow high note. And it would really give you a snapshot of music and youth culture across several decades.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think it would be pretty cool and interesting to do.
Yeah, so if you've never seen American Graffiti, I mean, it was the precursor to TV show, to Happy Days. Right, yeah.
It introduced the world to Harrison Ford.
Right.
And was the first big movie for a man named George Lucas, who made a little science fiction movie or something. I don't know.
Yeah. A science fiction series of films.
Something about Flash, something like Flash Gordon, like it had like space wizards in it or something.
This big furry monster thing. You might have heard of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Wars in space.
Ray guns and things. something called cookies.
Yes,
maybe.
But yeah, I mean, it is interesting to see Lucas kind of direct something that isn't, you know, like sci-fi. You know,
Do you remember when he was way more interested in like interpersonal like acting?
Well, I actually probably have to do American Graffiti
at some point. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know what we prepare it with.
That's a conversation for a different time, I think.
If you have suggestions, hit us up. We're on Twitter. Let us know in the show note or in the show we have discussed on our website. Just find us.
Yeah, find us on you know, video-culture.com.
If you've got something good to go with that movie, that'd be great.
Yeah, we're also on Twitter at videoculture2 for two guys talking about movies. Got to get that plug in.
All right.
Got a shill to pay the bills.
Yeah. Anytime. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed talking about music this week.
I had fun, man. I had
so
fun.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Videoculture2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Happy, and the ratings are soaring at Q Sky Radio.
We have done it, and we are going to cook and cook and cook and cook.
But the top brass think things could be even better.
Just go sending the dude here to get these big accounts to put spots on our station.
I'm Regis Lamar from Chicago.
Look, pal, I don't give a shit. You're the Messiah from Jerusalem. Come here to make my life perfect.
What do they care about music?
Well, to tell you the truth, I can take it or leave it.
All I care about is money.
Wall-to-wall commercials!
Yeah, too bad we can't get rid of the music completely, huh?
Yeah!
Everybody has to bend a little.
We're gonna let them do this to us?
No way.
Okay!
Starring Michael Brandon, Eileen Brennan, and Martin Mull. Special concert appearances by Jimmy Buffett.
That's all right. Yeah, be rocking and a rolling on a Linux on Saturday night.
And Linda Ronstadt.
Escape one. Please call up the lines. You're busy. Just try again.
FM on video cassette.